The following Veterans Radio program is dedicated to all the submariners in every country throughout the world.
All across America and around the world, you're listening to America's number one program for veterans, Veterans Radio. And now, live from the studios of WDEO in Ann Arbor, Michigan, here's your host for today's program, formerly of the 101st Airborne and the Big Red One, Bob Gould.
Thank you very much, Maddie, and welcome all of you military men and women that I'm going to be saying a very special Veterans Radio hello to. And here we are at the studios of WDEO and Ave Maria Network in beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. We're going to have a great program for you today. Of course, we always do all the time. We have a great program. Today's program, Don Keith, submarines. I love submarines. Yeah, here we go. The Final Patrol. Mr. Don Keith is going to be with us today. We're going to be talking about the USS Batfish. But before we do that, I want to introduce my partner, Mr. Gary Lilly. Can we go on over there to Gary? Because I just love the way Gary looks. Look at this, folks. Look how he's, I mean, he's a mariner today. Look how he showed up. Look at that. He's got the pea coat. He's got the watchman's sweater. And he has something else, right?
Oh.
Yes. Three bells.
You got to hit it. Ship spell.
Well, that's the way he showed up for coffee this morning, folks, and I just love it. I just had to show that. He looks the part. Looks the part. Well, Gary, good morning.
Good morning, Bob. It's great to be here. This is always so much fun. I look forward to this. When we leave the booth, I'm looking forward to the next one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's been about, 370 programs, 360?
Right.
7 years.
Seven and a half years. Closer to that. Yep.
Gary, you have something else with us today, and somebody on the line, why don't you tell our listeners about that?
Well, this morning we've got Bev Lineski, the Director of Volunteer Services at the Ann Arbor Veterans VAMC, the Veterans Administration Medical Center. And this is National Salute to Veteran Patients Week. We're just winding it up. Beverly, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm just terrific, Beverly. Gee, so nice of you to... You went into your office today, and you're sitting at your office so you could talk about this.
I am, but today is UAW Day at the hospital.
What is that?
United Auto Workers are doing programs today in conjunction with our National Salute to Veterans. So they've kind of declared today UAW Day, and they're having a lot of programs today for the inpatients.
Well, that's great. You know, the unions are really big at supporting veterans and hospitalized veterans. That's really terrific. Every union local has a veterans committee. What is the week all about, Bev?
National Salute to Veterans is conducted at all the VA medical centers across the nation, and it's an opportunity for the community, for civic groups, to come in and pay honor to the veterans for their service. And usually it's a busy week with lots of visitors, congressional folks, celebrities, events for the program. And a new thing that's been added to National Salute to Veterans is community concerts to raise public awareness about National Salute. The Detroit VA had a concert last Saturday with the Temptations, and Battle Creek VA in Michigan had a concert this past Monday. And they were community concerts to kind of just let the public know what the VA is all about.
What kind of, other than the unions, what kind of groups, you said celebrities, people come as groups?
This week in Ann Arbor, and again, this goes on nationwide, in Ann Arbor we had Red Wings alumni come in this week. We had some boxers from Crocs Gym in Lansing. We were very fortunate in that we had Governor Schneider and Mrs. Debbie Dingell come yesterday afternoon, Friday, to visit our patients.
Oh, that's great to know that the politicians are aware of all this. Hey, with the Red Wing alumni, was Ted Lindsay there?
He was not.
Oh.
There were a couple of other
I only ask that because I played against them once.
Oh, okay.
I was a goalie.
Okay, you were a goalie. Wow, that's exciting.
We'll have to talk about that.
Especially when you're playing against Ted Lindsay and his line.
Okay.
That was the year after you retired.
Ah, okay. Very good.
So how can other groups do this?
Need to do is contact their local chief of voluntary service, and we welcome the public and the community in all year round, not just during National Salute. And they would just contact their local chief of voluntary service at the VA, and they would work with us, and we would make arrangements for them to come in.
How many volunteers do you have during the year?
During the year, Ann Arbor has about 1,000. And those volunteers last year contributed 85,000 volunteer hours and about $800,000 in monetary and in-kind donations. So the impact of the volunteer program in Ann Arbor is about $2 million a year that the volunteers bring in.
That's fantastic. And you administer all of that and keep track of everybody?
I do. I do. I'm very blessed. I've been doing this for almost 13 years.
And you've been doing a good job. You're just
Thank
so
you.
Well known to the veterans community. Bev, thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio. Bob, did you have anything you wanted to ask Bev?
No, I didn't, Gary. I did want to say a little something about Welcome Home. Each week on Veterans Radio, we have in the past Welcome Home individual units returning to the U.S. after being serving somewhere else within the world. We're not doing that right now. There is a lot of groups. Instead, we're going to, have an omnibus, have a general Welcome Home from Veterans Radio to all the servicemen and women who are returning home. God bless.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Back to Veterans Radio, and that is the sound of sonar tracking submarines. Now, you know, we know something like that technology is so prevalent today, but
well,
back
they
then
can,
that was
they
all
can hear,
new stuff.
They can sit over by North America and hear a Russian sub leaving the base over there in the Soviet Union.
We did a program on that, remember? We did about 3 years ago on the Orion, and they were dropping those sonar buoys. But things were so different back in February 1945. And on the line with us today, our guest is going to be Don Keith, author of, can we get this, guys? Final Patrol. Mr. Don Keith is calling us right now from his home in. Don, where are you calling from?
Alabama.
Crimson Tide. Here we go. Mr. Don Keith, co-author of 21 books, including The Forever Season, Final Bearing, In the Course of Duty, Final Patrol. He also co-authored Bear Bryant, The Life and Times of Coach Paul Bear Bryant, The Ice Diaries, which I'm going to read shortly. It's all about the Nautilus. Won't that be cool?
Right.
And their trip beneath. Can't wait.
You remember that?
I remember the story. I do. I remember the story. War Beneath the Waves, which we did a program on, folks. You might want to check that out about 6 weeks ago. Go to the archives on our website. Great program, about a mutiny on a submarine. But I won't even go into that one right now. If you haven't, archive the program or buy the book, of course. So on the line with me right now, author of Final Patrol, talking about the USS Batfish and other submarines is Mr. Don Keith. Don Keith, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Bob, it is a delight to be on with you again. I really enjoy listening and being on the program.
And by the way, folks, we hope to have Mr. Don Keith here in Ann Arbor, Michigan during the art fair. I know I can give that scoop. Wouldn't that be
cool?
You've
been threatening to abduct me and get me up there. So.
Well, but we're gonna have other things, too. We'd like to include a little military group, but it would start with the Penguin House folks. So, but anyway, we won't get into that. Final patrol. Don, how many submarines, we talked about this, how many submarines were built thereabouts in World War II?
During the war itself, there were about 600 boats built in the U.S., primarily at Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Manitowoc, Wisconsin. That amazes a lot of people that we built submarines on the Great Lakes, but we did. And out at Mare Island, California, and a few in other spots around the country, but those are the primary places. We were cranking those things out in a hurry because we had to.
Well, that was the, I'm going to say this right, Balao class, correct? These are diesel boats. These are boats.
They use it, yeah, Balao, and then later in the war, the Gato class submarine. It's G-A-T-O, which is Spanish for cat, but they don't pronounce it with the Spanish A. It's Gato and Balao.
Now, 600 submarines. 600 submarines. How many are left?
It's hard to tell because a lot of the submarines after World War II either went into, not dry dock, they left most of them sitting in water somewhere, but a lot of them went to foreign navies, a lot of them were used for target practice, a lot of them were used for scrap. Most of them ended up getting scrapped. But right now, in the United States, there are 17 submarines that actually fought in World War II that are set up as museum ships that you can visit. There are 16 U.S. boats and one German U-boat.
That U-boat would be at Chicago, right?
Yep, that's the U-505, which is a great story. I've actually put off doing a book about her because it was such an interesting story, but I've had so many other things in the works.
I remember the 505 going through the Detroit River when I was young, and I remember seeing how they had to put it up on blocks and then haul it over to the museum across Lakeshore Drive, and quite a remarkable feat in itself. I wanted to ask you a question, though, about these submarines. They cranked out 600. Did they jeopardize safety at all in the speed that they were building them?
Absolutely not. That's one of the amazing things. Our submarine program has always been the safest in the world, but they actually were put a lot more stock in things like crew comfort because they realized the Balao class submarine actually had been in development for 20 years, but they didn't get around to starting to build them until about a year before World War II started. That's because some visionary people knew that we were going to fight a totally different kind of war in the Pacific, and crew comfort would be an important part of that because they would be fighting in such a hot, steamy climate. There was even a practical reason besides just keeping the crew comfortable, though, is the old submarines and the U-boats had a big problem with this in the Caribbean. If they didn't have good air conditioning, the moisture inside the hull of the submarine was so bad, they would have all sorts of electrical problems and shorts and mold and rust, and your uniforms wouldn't dry. You were just miserable all the time.
I think we have some shots of that, guys. Can you get up there? Whoa, look, Paul. Can you see that, Gary?
Yeah, that's remarkable.
What is that, Don?
That looks like it's probably in the control room. It's a little hard to tell. I think that's in the control room.
I see a bunch of valves there. It looks like they're for turning air and pressure gauges and such.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with this picture, but is that a U-boat?
Oh, yeah. And there, that must be the... Now, the next shot that you went to, guys.
With the periscope?
Yep. Yeah.
I know your radio listeners think we're all goofy, but these are some good pictures.
We have to say this. We are webcamming right now, so when you go to our website, you will be able to see us right now. So just go to the website, and what else? We have anything else, guys? No. Okay.
Well, yeah, that's definitely in the conning tower there.
Hot cots.
Yep. The hot bucks, the Germans did it even more than the U.S. boats did. You get off watch, you go hop in a cot, some guy just got out of it, you stay there for 4 hours and sleep, you get up, some other guy jumps in after you.
And we hope he showers, maybe, eh?
Oh, no, you didn't shower on those boats. There was no water.
I've got a question, Don. I hear the term fleet submarine. Is there, I assume that means that they go up long distance. Is there another designation for a submarine?
Yeah, that's an interesting story. The fleet boats were the Beleo and the Gato class boats, and they were so named because there were still a lot of people in the Navy that thought the primary purpose for a submarine was to protect harbors and shoreline and to shield a fleet. If you had a convoy of warships, then the submarine would ride along with those with the convoy, the fleet. And the problem with our older boats were they weren't fast enough to keep up with the average convoy. So,
you mean like the carriers, right? And the battleships.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, we're going to talk about one particular boat. And by the way, I didn't say ship, did I, folks? Oh, I want to mention this. If any how did you say that, Gary?
Submariners,
right. Okay, submariners, call 877-573-7825. That's phone number, 877-573-7825. We'd like to hear about that right now. So give us a call, 877-573-7825. Doesn't matter if you're World War II, Korea, Vietnam, you're on the sub-duty now, whatever, we'd like to hear from you. Let's talk about one particular boat, the USS Batfish. Tell us a little bit about the Batfish and her last, or that war patrol that she was so distinguished for.
Yeah, the Batfish was just a very typical submarine that was built in the very early part of the war. She had a distinguished career. I don't have the tonnage right here in front of me right now, but she did sink quite a bit of enemy shipping. But her primary claim to fame is something that happened north of Borneo in 1944 when the intelligence had picked up word that an unusual number of Japanese submarines was in the area. An unusual number, by the way, is four Japanese submarines. They only had five left in that entire squadron because we had sunk so many of them. But word was that these four submarines were running down to the Philippines and picking up some of the Japanese officers, some of the collaborators, some of the Japanese officers' mistresses, and the rumor was a fortune in gold. And these submarines were going to bring those folks back to the home islands of Japan just ahead of MacArthur's return to the Philippines. So USS Batfish, her captain, Jake Fife, were on alert to be on the lookout for submarines. Now, we should point out it is extremely difficult for one, or it was in those days, for one submarine to sink another submarine just because of... Even if a submarine's running on the surface, it's typically running at about 18 to 20 knots, which is pretty fast. It has the capability of diving very quickly, and if it's running on the surface, it's typically going to be zigzagging, and it's hard to hit. If you miss, the submarine's going to immediately dive, and you won't know where she is. You can track some with sonar, but they're just elusive devils. That's the nature of what.
Well, you also, I want to point out to our folks, and also, Don, you might want to comment, that there also is the other dynamic besides going left and right. They go up and down.
Absolutely. So it's just extremely difficult for one submarine to sink another. It was in those days. It's easier now with computer-guided torpedoes and all that sort of thing. But back in those days, you didn't have the luxury of that sort of technology. You pretty much had to rely on sonar. Now, if the submarine's on the surface, you're on the surface, you can see it, you have a reasonable chance of shooting it just like any other surface vessel. But once he pulls the plug and he's gone, and it's really hard to reacquire. Now,
Were we not having some problems with our torpedoes at that time?
We were having a lot of problems with our torpedoes. They simply would not run at the depth to which they were set to run. And then if they hit, they often wouldn't explode. Now, there's big controversy within the Navy. I know which side I come down on. I think some of the people in the higher reaches of the Navy just completely ignored the problem because one of the admirals who designed the exploder on those torpedoes was one of the top officers in the submarine service at the time and oversaw ordnance, and he just refused to acknowledge that his exploder was not working properly. But as the war went on, the guys started disarming that exploder completely and just relied on impact to set off the torpedo, because they would actually, one skipper even called it, we clinked them with a clunk, which means that they could hear the torpedo hit the hull of the ship and it would not explode. But a lot of people in the higher reaches of the Navy would not believe that was going on. Finally, Charles Lockwood got some sample torpedoes that came back from ships that had gone to war. He fired them against an undersea cliff in Hawaii and proved that over half of them failed. And that's when they completely changed, went to a totally new detonator, and by that point, the war was almost over anyway, but that hastened the end of the war.
Well, we have about 9 minutes before the break, and I want to get into that story, February 1945, Batfish. Let's go back to the South China Sea.
All right, the Batfish spotted one of those submarines on the surface. I guess I ought to point out, too, that in the entire war, we only sank 7 Japanese submarines with our submarines. Now, our submarines were unbelievably effective during the war, with less than 2% of the total naval force being represented by submarines. They sank over 50% of all the shipping that was lost by the Japanese during the war. So a lot of damage by a very small unit. But we only got 7 Japanese submarines with our submarines in the entire war, and Batfish was going to get 3 of them within 3 days. She stalked. Sank the first submarine on the second one. It took about, if I recall, about 15 hours before they were able to finally get lined up for a good shot. They missed the first time. They had to shoot again, multiple attempts. They finally sank the second. Within just a little over 3 days, they were able to sink 3 German submarines, now, almost half of all the submarines we sank.
Now, that had never happened before.
Nope, never happened before, and as far as I know, has never happened since.
Has never happened since. There was something also unique. Did you have something to add, Gary?
Right. You meant Japanese submarines, not German submarines, correct?
Right. Ooh, let's don't get mixed up with the German submarines.
Oh, I know I heard that too, but we all know that. We know. We're in the South China Sea. Right. But good thought. But wasn't there something about that first attack and a hot torpedo?
Yeah. As will occasionally happen, if they neglect to open the outer torpedo door, or if the outer torpedo door jams, that's by the way, the first thing you do when you get ready to fire a torpedo is open the door, you flood the tube, seawater actually comes in, and when you fire the torpedo, you're basically using compressed air to flush that torpedo out, and then once it's flushed out, the engine on the torpedo itself starts, the motor starts. It has a little spinning device in the nose of the torpedo that starts spinning, and once it has spun up to a certain point, the torpedo is then armed. That way you don't have an armed torpedo sitting there in your torpedo tube waiting to be fired. But in this occasion, the door jammed. They fire the torpedo. It jams at the door. And, of course, the big worry is the actual forward motion of the submarine going to spin the armor, the device that arms the torpedo. Is that enough to get it spinning? And if it gets armed, it's prone to go off at any time. And if the torpedo explodes in one of those tubes, it almost certainly is going to take the boat down with it. Now, that happened on this instance.
Now they didn't know that. They knew that they had fired it once, but they didn't know how much it had cleared out of the sub. So what happened at that point?
Well, you know, I don't remember the exact instance on this one, but what they would typically do if they were out in the middle of nowhere, you surface. You send a guy over the side, and he takes a look. In some cases, this happened with the USS Wahoo, which is one of the most famous submarines of World War II, with Mush Morton, where a torpedoman, during a test, fired the wrong tube, and they didn't have the door open. And luckily, it was the number one tube, so it was the topmost torpedo tube in the front of the boat, and they were able to surface, flood the back part of the boat so they could raise the bow up just enough so they could take a look at it, and they were able to determine that the torpedo had not armed, the door was open about an inch. They went ahead and did the rest of that patrol with a live torpedo sitting there with its nose stuck out the torpedo door. Now, in Batfish, they didn't have that luxury. They were in enemy territory, so they just had to continue on and hope that it didn't explode.
I was going to say, here we are in the middle of an attack, and you have a hot torpedo. You don't know whether it's been armed or not. You're the captain. You're Captain Fry. You don't know. You're in the middle of this dramatic moment. What do you tell your crew?
You tell them to fight on.
I believe that.
What else can you do? you've got an enemy target out there. Now, there were some skippers that would have said, hey, let's back off.
Yeah,
let's go
right.
Somewhere else. Let's wait till dark. Let's surface, said the guy over the side.
No, yeah.
Oh, you've got an enemy submarine in sight. You want to try to sink it.
Now, this was part of the new breed captain of the boats. This was not the desk people that were turned into submariners. How's that, Gary? I got that, eh? That were turned into submariners. That this is the new part of the Mush Morton group. Am I right? This is that kind of aggression.
Yeah, although I'll tell you this, about 3 years ago at the U.S. Submarine Veterans Association, they took a vote on whether they wanted to be called submariners or submariners.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And submariners won by about 75%.
Oh, did you hear that, Gary? No, he didn't. Okay, I'll tell him during the break. So there we have this hot torpedo. They were they able to actually fire that at their target, or was it just shot and let go?
Well, what they had to do, and again, I don't recall exactly. It's been a while since I wrote this story, but what they would typically do is try to, if they saw the torpedo had not yet armed, of course, if it was armed, you got a real big problem. But if it had not yet armed, then they would try to, when they could surface, hook a chain, actually open the torpedo door on the torpedo room side, hook a chain fall to it, and try to winch that thing back inside and get it safe. Or at least try to put chocks around it so it wouldn't shift and wouldn't open the door anymore or whatever, and do all they could do to get the torpedo door closed. The big problem there was if that torpedo door is left open, and you have to dive, you can only go down about 100 feet is about as far as you would want to go, because then you risk flooding.
Okay, so they were in dire straits at that moment. They were not only attacking, but they were, in a sense, attacking themselves, sort of internally. Wow, what a story. And again, I'm talking with Don Keith, author of, and do we have that right here? The Final Patrol. Right now we're talking about the story in February 1945 of the USS Batfish. So there they are now, and they were able, they saw the explosion. They saw the explosion of the other submarine. And there was a moment, too. Wasn't there a moment where the captain thought that these were fellow submariners, and didn't he make a statement to the crew?
Exactly, and I don't want to lose the thought about the difference in submarine skippers as the war went on. I want to talk a little bit about that a little later on, because that is a subject near and dear to my heart, because I just completed the book, just sent the manuscript off this week, Bob, about Mush Morton. And
we will be talking about that third segment, truly.
But the actual stalking and shooting of those three submarines came so quickly, and it was so much just based on good training, the skill of the crew. I don't want to say it was routine, because obviously with a hot torpedo run and trying to shoot a ship that's hard for another submarine to sink, and you're in enemy territory, you don't know if you're going to get attacked from the air or if a destroyer or patrol craft's going to come along. I don't want to make it seem routine, but it was almost routine the way the guys did this.
And you're confined, and you're claustrophobic, and you're scared,
sure,
and you're sweaty, and this was all going on. Wow, I love it. Final Patrol, I love that section that you wrote on that.
This is one of the most heartrending things I've ever seen. After they had sunk the third submarine, and you really have to understand what a close brotherhood the submarine service is. I know guys who share foxholes. I know people who share the cockpit of a bomber. There are strong bonds of friendship and brotherhood there. But if you imagine 70 to 80 guys locked inside the steel hull of one of these vessels fighting an enemy that they can't even see, only one guy is looking through that periscope, that forms one of the strongest brotherhoods, the Brotherhood of the Dolphin, they call it, because they wear those twin dolphin pins. But after they had sunk the third German submarine, Jake Fife gets on the 1MC, which is the PA system that runs throughout the boat, and he makes a little speech, and he talks about, I know in our hearts how sad we are that we have taken the lives of brother submariners on three ships.
Okay, but why don't you hold your thought on that one, Don, because we're coming up on a break in just a few seconds. You're listening to Don Keith, Final Patrol, Bob Gould, Veterans Radio. We will be right back.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Major Patrick Brady rescued 51 men in one day. Details after this.
This is Dale Thronberry of Veterans Radio reminding you that coming up this Monday night, February 21st at 9 o'clock on Detroit Public Television is the local television premiere of an amazing documentary sponsored by the American House. Our Vietnam Generation, produced by award-winning Keith Famey, is also produced, who also produced Detroit's Greatest Generation about the Motor City's World War II veterans. Our Vietnam Generation tells the story of Detroit's men and women during one of the most divisive periods in American history. The men and women of Detroit fought on a battlefield as brutal as any other and more deadly than most wars in the history of the United States. The major difference, these veterans fought at the time when the United States was deeply divided over one of the most controversial wars in American history. Our Vietnam Generation focuses on the struggles experienced by many of Michigan's Vietnam veterans. They received a much different homecoming than those who went before them. Set against the backdrop of the 1960s, it was a time marked by music, drugs, free love, and political upheaval. Our Vietnam Generation is the story of many of Michigan's veterans who came home and were able to become successful business and community leaders, while others would continue suffering their physical wounds and haunting memories. This documentary also tells the story of the families of these veterans, including those who continue to hold yearly vigils in the hope of finding those still missing. According to the main sponsor of Our Vietnam Generation, American House founder Bob Gillette, it was a different kind of battle these people were fighting. The people fighting in Vietnam were not giving the heroes welcome when they returned home like our World War II veterans. This film is our opportunity to do what we should have done then. Don't miss this fascinating story of Detroit's Vietnam Generation this Monday evening at 9 o'clock on Detroit Public Television. Veterans Radio wants to add our thanks to Keith Famey and American House's Bob Gillette for their continuing support of America's veterans. Be there Monday night, 9 o'clock on Detroit Public Television. Don't miss Our Vietnam Generation. That's an order.
Brady was flying medevac helicopters on his second tour in Vietnam when he volunteered to rescue two badly wounded South Vietnamese soldiers in enemy territory. When he arrived, the site was shrouded in fog. He descended slowly until he saw the tops of trees and then moved sideways to the landing site. Despite heavy enemy fire, he was able to locate the soldiers and evacuated them. Brady was called to another fogged-in area where American casualties lay close to enemy lines. He lowered his chopper through the fog and found a stream bed that led to the wounded. In all, he made five flights to rescue 39 GIs. On his third mission, the controls on his chopper were hit, but he managed to get home. He got a replacement chopper and returned. On his fourth mission, Brady watched a mine explode near the landing site, forcing another medevac to leave. Brady went in and set his chopper in the skid marks of the other craft. Two crew members were carrying a stretcher to the chopper when one stepped on a mine. The explosion blew a hole in Brady's craft. He managed to get it off the ground and delivered the six severely wounded men to the aid station. He picked up another helicopter and kept flying. In all, he evacuated 51 men that day. 400 bullet holes were counted in the helicopters he flew that day. Brady went on to become a major general in the United States Army. He was awarded the Medal of Honor by President Nixon on October 9th, 1969.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
Okay, we're back on the air right here, Veterans Radio from beautiful Ann Arbor, Michigan. I have with me as my co-host, Mr. Gary Lilly, and on the line right now is Mr. Don Keith, author of The Last Patrol, and we're talking about the USS Batfish and their final patrol. No, it was not their final patrol, but it was one of their final. I think it was number 6 out of 7, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right, Don?
That's correct.
Okay. They received something. What was the award that was given to the crew on the presidential side?
The Presidential Unit Citation, which is one of the highest awards for the crew of a submarine.
And when did that start? Well, that would probably... Was that being awarded in World War One?
That's a good question.
Uh-huh.
I know it definitely was in World War II because Batfish got one of them.
You know, stump the author. That's what we try to do. Gary, would you know anything about that? No, you.
I don't know if it was World War II. That's a good question. But no, I don't know that.
Okay. Well, now it received the unit The unit received the citation from the president, received other very fine distinguished awards. It went on to have one more patrol, number 7. It then was retired. And the war ended. And all these submarines were being scrapped. They were being cannibalized, scrapped. They were made into
old
tuna fish cans and whatever, which is
razor
kind of
blades.
Razor blades. God, you mean I might be shaving with the both in? I hope not. No, that's in Pearl Harbor.
Oh, both in still there.
Yeah, right. Oh, well, but they were slowly disappearing. And of all places, Oklahoma. A group of submarine guys getting together and saying, we need to preserve something. Oklahoma, Dust Bowl. How did we go from the Atlantic to the Dust Bowl, Don?
Well, we were talking about how strong the Brotherhood of Submariners is. And I want to go back just real quickly to that speech that Jake Fife made to his crew just after they sank the third submarine that day. He said, you know, within 3 days, we sank 3 enemy submarines. There were no survivors. Those men aboard those Japanese submarines died as a result of our actions as combatant enemies. They knowingly risked their lives just as we do. We attacked and sank them in the course of our duty. Within our good fortune that we did not lose our boat or our lives is, of course, some sadness that these submariners have died and by our hand. Do you know how remarkable that is? Here's a captain that's just, and he and his crew have just fought their hearts out.
That is remarkable. And to say that at such a moment.
Well, it was such a power. When in the course of our duty, I use that for the title of a book I did about Batfish herself, just about Batfish, in the course of duty. That, by the way, I was sitting here working one day in my office. I get a phone call. It's Captain William Anderson, the second captain of Nautilus and the fellow who took her to the North Pole in 1958. Captain Anderson had gotten my number from my agent, and he said, Don, what are you working on? And I told him I was in the middle of a project, and he said, stop it. I want you to help me. And he asked me to help him write the story of Nautilus and the North Pole, and he had made that decision to call me based on in the course of duty and that passage in the book where we talked about what those brother submariners had done to their brothers across the ocean there. Anyway, getting back to...
Yeah, let's get back to the Dust Bowl.
Yep, the submarine vets of Oklahoma had some political pull, and they talked the legislature of the state of Oklahoma into creating the Oklahoma Maritime Commission. If you can imagine a landlocked state with a maritime commission. And this group was charged with getting a museum submarine, a real submarine that they could bring back to the state of Oklahoma and set up as a museum ship. Now, the state legislature did not authorize this group to enter contracts or to write checks or commit money or run up bills or anything else. But these guys get down to New Orleans to pick up the submarine that they've been told to get by name, a particular submarine. They take a look at it. That old submarine was all rusty and looked terrible and didn't really have that distinguished a record. But sitting right there next to her at the slip in New Orleans in the Mississippi River was the Batfish. And several of the guys on the commission knew Batfish's record. She was known as the submarine killer submarine because of what she did. They made the command decision right there on the wharf at New Orleans to not get the boat they were supposed to get, but to get the Batfish and bring her back. And
did they let the Navy know?
They had to let the Navy know. Yep. They never let the Oklahoma Maritime Commission know, though, the state legislature. And they immediately began signing contracts, and they committed to bring her back up the Mississippi and the Arkansas River and all the way to Muskogee, Oklahoma. They didn't really know where they were going to park her when they got her back. But they knew they had themselves a distinguished and heroic submarine, and they knew it was perfect for the museum that they were going to create there.
Would they pay for it?
Ended up not paying anything for it. The way it works, and by the way, if you're a group and you want to get a submarine and there's one available, as long as you convince the Navy that you're going to take good care of it.
That's great.
You can get it.
That's...
It's not as easy as it looks. The final patrol, and the reason for the title of that book is, it's about those 17 World War II submarines that are museum ships, and it tells the story of how their final patrol was up some river or across some lake somewhere to sit there as a museum ship so we can go visit them.
Well, you know, we have this. Can we have that photograph? Okay. Well, they put it on barges at that point, and then what happened?
Well, that's the interesting part. Parts of the Arkansas River are very shallow. There also are some extremely low bridges along the way. And
did they Don? Did they take the keel out?
They did not. There was some talk about maybe taking the conning tower off, but that's how they used to get the boats that were built up in Wisconsin. They would float those down the Lake Michigan through the Chicago River and over to the Mississippi. They would not put the conning tower and the shears on the boat until they got them down to New Orleans because of all those low bridges. But they came up with this plan. They used those four barges, and they actually had a strap underneath, so it's kind of like she's in a hammock, the way they've got it arranged. And they floated it with a tugboat right up the Mississippi, which was really no problem. But after they made the left-hand turn onto the Arkansas River, it got to be pretty dicey in some places. They actually had to lower the river at Little Rock to get her under a railroad bridge there.
How in the world did they do that?
They had a dam up the river there a ways, and they were able to actually close some floodgates and allow the river to sink just enough that they could creep under that railroad bridge there.
And then they got to the Arkansas, dug this, what we're looking here at these photographs.
Yep.
And tell us a little bit about that. Wow.
Well, luckily, the Corps of Engineers had been doing a lot of work on the Arkansas River, flood control and that sort of thing, and they were able to raise the river enough there that they could get over some shallow spots. The original plan had been to go all the way to Tulsa. They were going to put the boat there, but it was quickly determined that the Corps of Engineers had not been able to do enough work that far north to be able to get to Tulsa, and Muskogee made them an offer to give them a place there to park it on the river, and that's where the museum would be, a World War II museum, not just for Batfish.
And there, if you don't have your webcam on, Don,
you're ahead of my story here. They originally were going to park there in the river and just build a little bridge over so tourists could come aboard, but she almost washed away the first spring with the floods. So then they decided, well, we're going to have to get this thing further inland. So they dug a trench, dug a canal, they hooked up a bulldozer, and they towed the submarine up into a moat there about 300 yards from the Arkansas River. That moat, and if you're watching on Ustream, you can see the canal they dug there. And the original plan was to set the submarine in that moat, fill the moat up with water, and put various aquatic animals, including seals and sea lions and an assortment, a menagerie around it. And then somebody had the good sense to realize steel sitting in water is not a real good mix because it will deteriorate. So they never did fill that moat up. But if you visit the submarine, she's still sitting there in an indentation in the earth in the middle of what used to be a bean field in the middle of the Dust Bowl in the Cherokee Nation. As far as I know, she's still, it's the highest altitude any submarine has ever been. She's
above
sea level.
For all the submariners out there, that would be a very interesting and very great little statement. It is right now in elevation, right, the highest. We got about 30 seconds before we go to the break. So it's now in Muskogee. It's in a museum. What's the name of that museum?
It's called the Oklahoma World War Museum.
And that's
Muskogee War Museum, actually, yeah.
And that's in Muskogee, Oklahoma.
It's in Muskogee, Oklahoma, which is, again, right in the middle of the Cherokee Nation, about 30 miles from Tulsa.
Well, that just goes to show you, folks, what a group of military folks can do with politicians and a little help from the community. What an amazing story. We're going to be right back here on Veterans Radio with Don Keith, Final Patrol. We'll be right there.
Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 for your no-charge consultation.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University.
By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Okay, we're back here at Veterans Radio. Bob Gould, along with Gary Lilly, also joining me now in the studio, is going to be Dale Thronberry in just a moment. And we have on the line Mr. Don King, author of Final Patrol. By the way, folks, if you are listening on Ustream and you see me making all these gestures and things, it's not for the guests. It's because I want to keep the photographs moving. So that's why I'm doing all that and back and forth.
You are very animated.
I'm animated. I'm having a good time.
You've got to have the strongest arms in the world.
I'm like a conductor. I love it. Okay, Don, here we are. And I must apologize, I did have a photograph of that sub of the Batfish there in the bean field. I would like folks to go to the website, www.batfish.com, and take a look. They actually have a virtual tour, and they have stories. And Don, when's the last time you've been there?
It's been, way too long. I would love to go back. And you're absolutely right. If you get a chance to visit batfish.org, and it's really one of the best virtual tours of a diesel submarine that you will find anywhere. You get a real good idea of what the submarine looks like and how it works. So they got pictures, and they've done a remarkable job with that.
And now that summertime is coming, people are making vacation plans. And one of the things that you and I talked about when we pre-interviewed was going to be your time to talk about some of these places that folks can go to visit some of these museums and
Absolutely.
See these submarines.
And I would like to salute the guys who are keeping these boats not afloat, because although some of them are afloat, but a lot of the work that goes into keeping these boats up is done by volunteers. That's certainly the case with the Batfish. They have a great group of volunteers out there. It's been tough down through the years. You know, you lose volunteers, you pick up volunteers, and it costs money. And believe me, the museum does not make enough money to keep that boat in good shape and follow all the regulations they have to follow. And the Navy is if the Navy should visit and decide they're not doing a good job of keeping Batfish up, they could tell them they're taking it back, and they could float it back down the river. It wouldn't be easy, I'll tell you.
No.
But as we mentioned at the start, there are 17 World War II museum ships out there. There are quite a few other ships, including the Nautilus, by the way, which you can see up in Groton, Connecticut. It's one of only two historic ships, the Nautilus. And you know what the other historic ship is in this country?
Go ahead, Gary.
Old Ironsides, USS.
Old Ironsides. Exactly.
You can't stump the Veterans Radio crew.
But of these 17 World War II boats, they're all over the country. They're in Pittsburgh, they're in Baltimore, they're in Buffalo, they're in Cleveland, a lot of unusual places. They're in Charleston, South Carolina, Mobile, Alabama, on Galveston Island. There's one at Pearl Harbor, the Bowfin.
That's the Bowfin, when we did that with War Beneath the Waves, by the
exactly.
way, folks, which is on our archives. And now, these particular boats, are they all in full, condition, or are they maybe might have a control room of one when you're talking about this and half of the suburb? How does that work out?
More or less, they are in remarkable condition, and tourists or visitors can go to just about any compartment aboard them. Some of them still have working periscopes. A couple of them even have radar you can turn on. The USS Cod at Cleveland is in remarkable shape, and they've got a great group of volunteers there. The Cod can still fire off those diesel engines, and they do on occasion. It makes a lot of smoke, a lot of noise, but it's something to behold.
Don, perhaps you could tell us which one is on the Lake Michigan shore of Michigan, because I know groups like Boy Scout groups can go and spend the night there.
Yeah, well, actually, practically all of those are open for overnight stays and that sort of thing. You're testing my memory now.
Is that the Silverfish?
Yes, the Silverfish is over in Haddon Block.
I could probably look it up right here.
The unfortunate thing is it was not made, it was not manufactured there at Manitowoc. None of those, they call them the Great Lakes boats, none of those Lake Michigan boats are still around. They were all either lost in the war or went to foreign navies and have been destroyed or were cut up for razor blades. But you can sure see her there, and it's a remarkable sight to stand on the bridge where these captains stood.
Oh, yeah.
And to look out, especially if they're on the water, you can look out across that water and just imagine being at sea, looking for smoke on the horizon that could be a convoy. Of course, the second thing you look for was a patrol boat, a destroyer, or a cruiser. You didn't want to mess with those.
Up in the air, too.
Up in the air, right. I believe that is what Don, and you can comment on that. At the end, it was our air that sunk most of the submarines. Is that correct at the end?
Yes, it was. The depth charges did their damage, but bombs and air, because the planes move so fast, you could see them on radar. Early in the war, all we could see was a blip. We couldn't tell even what direction they were coming from. Later on, when the radar got better, it helped a lot. But Wahoo is a prime example. The Wahoo is the most historic submarine of all, and she was caught at about 100 feet depth. This plane could still see her underwater in that clear, cold water north of Hokkaido, and dropped one bomb and sank that great submarine.
Well, how about a segue into your project right now? Tell us a little bit about what you're doing.
Well, I've got a couple of projects. As I mentioned, that Wahoo and the story of Mush Morton, which was one of those skippers who came along at a time when we needed that mentality at the helm of these submarines. We needed somebody who was going to be aggressive. Prior to the war, most submarine skippers were taught to be defensive. Don't let the enemy know you're there. Attack only if you're dead sure you're going to be able to hit the target. Approach by sound, not by periscope, and for goodness sakes, don't spend any time on the surface except to charge the batteries and then duck again. That was not the way to win the war in the Pacific in World War II. And Mush Morton, Red Ramage, Moak Millikan, a whole new breed of skippers came along, and Morton was the first one who radically changed the way that submarine warfare was conducted. And that's the reason that the submarines were such a big factor in the war. Morton actually spent about three-quarters of the time on the surface. He knew that the Beleo and Gato-class submarines were extremely effective surface vessels. He used those 4-inch deck guns and the other armament that he had on the deck to actually do surface attacks. When he ran out of torpedoes on his first three patrols halfway through.
Well, we've got about 15 seconds. How can they find out where the books are available, and we can go from there?
Just go to donkeith.com. That's donkeith.com. And the books are all there, and always anxious to hear from folks and what you think about the books.
Thank you very much for being on the air, Don. This is your second appearance, and we're going to have you on again. I want to read the Ice Diaries and talk about the Nautilus. Gary, do you got something very quickly?
I wanted Matt to bring up the photograph of the sub on the barge or any sub that has those great look holes, great meaning G-R-A-T-E, and I wanted Don to tell us what the holes were all about.
Do we have that real quick?
Nope. Yep,
nope. Oh, there he is. Yeah, do you see those holes?
The holes along the side of the submarine, along the hull.
I think those are induction holes, aren't they?
Those are induction holes, yep. Again, to take on water, and blow out air. all the submarine is a bunch of tanks.
Okay, so the main hull, the pressure hull, is inside of... it's like a second shell, correct?
Yep, absolutely. It's like a second shell, and people see a submarine, and it's not nearly as big inside because most of that are tanks inside the hull, and that was one of the big innovations with the later versions of the submarine. That's why they could dive deeper and stay down longer, and, of course, a lot of those tanks held diesel fuel, too, and they would have to pump in seawater on top of the diesel fuel if they used the fuel up. Because you have to keep trim. You have to keep the same amount of weight.
Okay. Once again, Don, we're running out of time. We want to thank you very much for being on the program, and we'll be looking forward to Ice Diaries. You take care.
Thank you very much, Bob. Always enjoy it.
Okay, well, back to the crew. Dale, go.
Go.
You got something.
I just want to remind everybody, and especially in southeastern Michigan, to tune in to Detroit Public Television on Monday night at 9 o'clock to see our Vietnam Generation, which is a documentary about the Vietnam veterans of the southeast Michigan area, sponsored by the American House.
Now, that was Monday at what date? Which
the 21st of February at 9 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
2100 hours, right?
Close. Yep. That's 2100 hours.
We gotta start remembering that.
I start missing all that hundred stuff. Yeah.
It's a great documentary. Gary and I had the opportunity to see it down at the Fox Theater for its world premiere, and I think that the people of Detroit would be very proud of their Vietnam veterans.
Now, this is called The Vietnam Generation. We will be giving you more information on this, folks, on this particular project. Also, on WTVST, like in Tango, V like in Victor, S like in Sierra, maybe they can find that online, eh? WTVS?
The old
Channel 56 Detroit.
Well, you know, with cable, all those numbers have changed. So just look.
Well, right, but go online. But they go.
Go to the website, Detroit Public Television. That's
got it.
Where it is.
Oh, okay. That'll do it. Well, it's been a while since all three of us have been in the same room at the same time.
And it's been fun.
It's been nice seeing the other two gentlemen here and looking across the table to you guys. So right now, Veterans Radio, Bob Gould, Dale Thronberry, Gary Lilly. Yeah, until next program, you are dismissed.
Not all views and opinions expressed on this program reflect the views of Veterans Radio or your local station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.
Veterans, need help with your VA benefit claim? Then call Legal Help for Veterans right now at 800-693-4800. To ensure the best possible chance for success, our attorneys at Legal Help for Veterans are devoted to VA claim appeals, and they will forcefully present your particular case. So make that call today to Legal Help for Veterans at 800-693-4800 for your no-charge consultation.